The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Bryan, Judge Smith, Judge Brodenberg, the Honorable Jeffrey M. Bryan presiding. The first case is case number A210635, Boyski Enterprises LLC versus Sturzberg and Fine Incorporated.
Good morning to counsel and my colleagues. I want to thank you, first of all, for participating remotely today. And note that although we're not in person, we will proceed under the same rules as if we were at the Judicial Center. As you have heard, the proceedings are being audio recorded, so please state your name and the party that you represent before you begin your argument. And I want to say a couple other things. Number one, because we are using this video conferencing platform, you may be sitting in your office or at home. As I am at home, there may be interruptions, doorbells, pets, that sort of thing. And we understand that those can and do happen. And I don't want you to feel overly anxious about that. But we will accommodate those kinds of things as well as any interruptions in our video feed or technology problems. So like I said, we'll try to accommodate those, but we want to keep them to a minimum. If for some reason you can't hear me or there's a problem that you have, please let us know right away and we can make sure that you're entitled to all the time that you would have had if this had been in person. I also want to mention that there is a clock, and if you're in the gallery view, you should be able to see that clock just fine. But if you've toggled into the active speaker view, then it may be hard to see because all the other speakers then get minimized. They get really small. And so I want to encourage you to use that gallery view so that you can see the clock and know how much time you have left. And the last thing I want to say is that only the judges and the attorneys are permitted to speak, and we've disabled the ability of other participants to share their audio and video or make comments in the chat function. All right. So with that, it looks like is it Hines or Heinze?
Mr. Heinze, Your Honor.
Heinze. Mr. Heinze, you are an attorney for appellant, and if you're prepared to proceed, you may begin.
I can't. Thank you, Judge Bryan, Judge Rodenberg, Judge Smith. This is a complicated case that's been going on for over 5 years now. It's a case that's been before you before and the Supreme Court as well. I know you're going to ask me a number of questions regarding the issues before you, but I first want to briefly ensure that everybody knows the basic story here. Henry Sturzberg, the owner of defendant respondent Sturzberg and Fine, which is a Pennsylvania corporation, broke the law and defrauded Minnesota citizens by holding himself out as a licensed mortgage broker. He got caught, he got licensed after the fact, but still tried to get money from his illegal acts. He pleaded with this court to send the matter to arbitration, his lawyers again and again representing to this court and the Supreme Court that both under Minnesota and Pennsylvania law, under each state's Uniform Arbitration Act, the Pine County District Court would maintain jurisdiction and the Pine County District Court would be the only court to hear any post-arbitration actions. Not only did that turn out to be a lie, and not only did Sturzberg go on and administratively get a favorable arbitration award administratively entered as judgment in Pennsylvania courts, but Sturzberg's lawyers now represent to this court that no, Pennsylvania law requires that only Pennsylvania be the venue for post-arbitration actions. This case is about the audacity of Sturzberg's disdain for Minnesota and its laws. Remember that when considering the issues before you in this case.
Now, I ask you, counsel.
Yes.
With respect to your statements about the representations about what the Pine County District Court would do, I mean, the arbitration took place, as I understand, in Pennsylvania. Is that correct?
The arbitration took place in Pennsylvania. Okay. Yes.
And then motion to confirm the award occurred in Pennsylvania. You're claiming that there was a, I think you used the word lie, that it would, motion to confirm would take place in Pine County. Tell me, what is that? What is the significance of that? Like, what legal principle are you invoking to find a confirmation award in the state in which the arbitration occurred to be somehow infirm?
Sure. The legal principles behind it, and we're going to get a little bit ahead of in my planned comments, are as a concerned personal jurisdiction.
So I understand that, but I just want to ask, are you making some sort of estoppel argument or something that somehow, I don't understand what a representation about where it would be, if it's otherwise appropriate in Pennsylvania, What difference does it make whether the party understood at any point prior where the motion to confirm takes place?
That's correct, Your Honor. It is an estoppel argument or a waiver argument that they, that Sturzberg is now coming before us and saying that no, Pennsylvania is the correct venue and always has been the correct venue for any post-judgment, any post-arbitration motions, but they've waived that argument. They waived that argument both by appearing in Pine County Court in the first place, and they waived that argument by stating the exact opposite to this court and to the Supreme Court.
An argument. I mean, it sounds more like estoppel to me. You're trying to hold them to something. I'm wondering if you made an estoppel argument in the district court here.
We did, Your Honor, yes.
Okay, thanks.
Yes. So let's talk about the arbitration award first. Minnesota's law here is pretty straightforward. So under 572B.23, it says that this court shall vacate an arbitration award if the arbitrator exceeds their powers.
Mr. Heinze, I'm gonna interrupt real quick because I'm curious as to the applicability of the Minnesota Revised Uniform Arbitration Act in this case. So there's a federal arbitration act, and typically if there's some interstate commerce issue, then it's the FAA that would preempt and that would apply. And so I'm looking at the ADR options rules that was attached to your second affidavit from December 21 of 2020, Exhibit A. And the rule says that unless there's some written agreement to use either the Pennsylvania Uniform Arbitration Act or some similar statute, that the agreement is for what the rule calls common law arbitration rules. So my question is there a written agreement to use the Minnesota Revised Uniform Arbitration Act? Is there a written agreement to use the Pennsylvania version? Or are we instead trying to figure out what common law arbitration rules mean? Because as I understand things, the FAA would preempt that. So we're really looking at if there's a written agreement to use the Pennsylvania or the Minnesota Arbitration Act, fine. If there is no written agreement, then I believe we're really under the FAA here. So I'm curious as to why we're presuming applicability of the Minnesota Act, unless you can point me to some written agreement that I missed in the record.
Sure, Your Honor. So first, I believe that the term common law arbitration is a term of art in the state of Pennsylvania. So I believe that's where that term comes from. But the broader answer to your question is in rule number 10 of those arbitration rules, where it states that the law of the case shall be the substantive law of the jurisdiction where the case was filed. So that would include...
Right, but that's the law of the case. That's telling the arbitrator what law to apply. That's not saying what arbitration act applies or that's more the procedural aspect of things. So I don't see a specific statement that in the ADR options rules about what arbitration act applies. And I see a substantive law that you would have to apply, but that's different than which arbitration act applies. And now we're dealing with the exceptions to when the enumerated bases to vacate an award under the FAA. There are Eighth Circuit opinions, for example, that say that those enumerated reasons are the exhaustive list. That's it. So there is no additional public policy or additional manifest disregard option under the FAA, at least as many circuits, including the Eighth, have held it. So I think it's really an important question what Arbitration Act applies. And I don't think Rule 10 has anything to do with the procedural question before us. So is there some other written agreement to use something other than the Pennsylvania Uniform Arbitration Act or to use the Minnesota Uniform Arbitration Act as opposed to the FAA?
But yeah, two things, Your Honor. One, the Federal Arbitration Act does recognize an exception when the arbitrator exceeds his powers. So that's what we're talking about here primarily as it concerns vacating the arbitration award. As it concerns the public policy argument, that the public policy exception does come from the United States Supreme Court. And so that would cover an exception, an unwritten exception, an equitable exception to the Federal Arbitration Act under U.S. Supreme Court law binding precedent. So, and we're not talking about manifestation, or excuse me, a manifest disregard for the law. I know Mr. Bernheim talked about that a lot in his briefing, but that's not the argument being made here. The argument being made here is that the parties agreed to particular rules that this arbitration would be bound by, and that the arbitrator broke those rules twice. He broke those rules by awarding prejudgment interest, which he was not allowed to do under Rule 13. And he awarded, and he applied Pennsylvania law, which I think when you look at the totality of the arbitration record, which while the arbitration award itself is a one page, if that, document, you have a complete transcript of the arbitration, and you have a number of briefings from the parties, including two post-hearing memorandums submitted by both sides regarding which law applies. So I think it's clear from the record that the arbitrator applied Pennsylvania law here, which is in violation of Rule 10. But you don't even need to get there to vacate the arbitration. Simply by violating Rule 13, that is a that the arbitrator has gone beyond his powers. And so the rule that says that the arbitrator cannot exceed his powers does not say that he has to exceed it materially or substantially. If the arbitrator exceeds it by 1%, the court shall vacate the award.
But again, if we're looking at the federal, I mean, there's a lot of case law, and even, you know, going kind of to push back a little bit, going very different direction than the way you're characterizing it. In fact, there's a majority opinion in which Justice Scalia says that the law, as the arbitrator applies it, good, bad, or ugly, even if it's a grave legal error, and I think those are the words he uses, grave error, even a grave legal error is not exceeding the scope. So I'm not sure that your characterization is correct, at least not consistent with my understanding of how the FAA has been interpreted by the U.S. Supreme Court on exceeding of the scope.
I think, Your Honor, the distinction lies in what the parties agreed to. If the parties had, let's say, for example, the parties agreed to Minnesota law, and the which they did, and the arbitrator applies Minnesota law, and the arbitrator gets Minnesota law wrong, that's a different story. That falls into the category that Justice Scalia was talking about. However, when the parties agree to Minnesota law and the arbitrator says, no, I'm not going to apply Minnesota law, I'm going to apply this other thing, that's the violation. That's where he's exceeded his powers. So he hasn't exceeded his powers by getting the law wrong or misapplying the law that the parties agreed to. He got it by applying, he got it by violating the rules of the game that the parties agreed to in the first place.
I have a question, Mr. Heinzies, along those same lines, but sort of back one step. The case comes to us after the Court of Common Pleas in Pennsylvania has entered judgment, correct?
Correct. After they entered administrative affirmation of the arbitration award, correct.
But there was a petition to the Court of Common Pleas in Pennsylvania to which you could have responded. Am I right on that?
That is correct. Well, yes and no, Your Honor. So it was an administrative action. The time in which on the face of the document for which to respond, and forgive me, I don't have the dates right in front of me, but I believe it was on a Monday in November of 2020. The court actually administratively entered judgment prior to that date by about 4 or 5 days. So had my client decided to respond by that date, they were closed out by those actions. But yes, they could have, in general terms, responded. But again,
well, even that being so, let's say they did it out of order, you could have made a motion to the Court of Common Pleas, could you not?
We could have, Your Honor, but then we would have. Our client believed that Pennsylvania didn't have any jurisdiction over this case, and we knew under Minnesota law that we wouldn't waive that jurisdictional issue by not appearing before Pennsylvania court.
Well, having not appeared and there being a judgment, which, as I understand the record, has been docketed in Minnesota, correct?
It has, Your Honor.
How do we not give that judgment full faith and credit?
Well, for two reasons, Your Honor. One is the jurisdictional issue, which we've talked about briefly. But the other more important issue is Statute 82.85, which is a statutory bar to what Sturzberg and Fine is doing. If you look at the case law cited in the briefing, which is a U.S. Supreme Court case, which talks about that while sister states are to give full faith and credit to judgments, the method of execution of those judgments does not follow from state to state. In other words, if you're going to try to execute a judgment in a different state, you go by their rules. And the rules in Minnesota are very clear. You can't use the courts of this state for any action, which would include entry of a foreign judgment for enforcement of compensation for fees for services rendered while unlicensed. And it's clear from the arbitration award, which was then included into the Pennsylvania foreign judgment, that this was for fees for services rendered. And so for that very reason, Sturzberg cannot use the courts of this state to enforce his judgment. It's punitive and it's harsh, but that's what the legislature decided.
So your argument is that because Minnesota law, you're basing your argument to not give full faith and credit based on Minnesota law, because Minnesota law then is different, you're saying, from Pennsylvania law. So the court, even though it's not a fraud, you're arguing a jurisdiction. Let's say we reject your jurisdiction argument. It's not, you don't argue fraud. And let's say we reject jurisdiction. You're saying there's another thing that bars Minnesota from giving full faith and credit, and that's because Minnesota's law is different.
It's not because Minnesota's law is different, Your Honor. It's because it's Minnesota's law is different as it concerns the execution of that foreign judgment, as it concerns this particular case. It's not because Minnesota's law is different from Pennsylvania, and so therefore, because those laws are in conflict, you can't enforce the judgment. It's because the procedure is prohibited in Minnesota from executing that judgment.
You're saying chapter, is it
82.85, Your Honor.
85 addresses foreign judgments?
Yes, it addresses any use of the courts. So all parties are banned from all actions to collect compensation for unlicensed services rendered in this state. It's a hard statutory bar, Your Honor. And because it has to do, in this particular case, with the execution of a foreign judgment and based upon Supreme Court precedent that says that that full faith and credit is not absolute as it concerns how a foreign judgment is executed, Sturzberg has to play by Minnesota's rules as it concerns that judgment, and he's not allowed to use the courts of the state to collect upon that judgment in this narrow specific case.
Thank you, Mr. Heinze. Your time has expired. You do have a remaining time for rebuttal. We'll turn now to Mr. Bernheim.
Thank you very much. And good morning. Please, court. My name is Daniel Bernheim, and I have the privilege of representing the appellees here, Sturzberg and Fine, and with no disrespect to any of the parties, we've referred to them as Wolski and Sturzberg, and if I slip into that, I hope that will be okay. I appreciate the opportunity of appearing pro hoc and as well as virtual, and respectfully, I would submit that this analysis can begin and end with the full faith and credit. From listening to some of the questions, I suspect that there'll be a little bit more inquiry in the course of this presentation. But that's really where this begins and ends, that we have an appropriate order and judgment entered in Pennsylvania, which is deserved from an arbitration, which has been confirmed by the state court here, which is not administrative. It is not purely ministerial. There is a 30-day period before you can file and another 30-day period afterwards for which somebody has the option to come into the Court of Common Pleas and raise whatever objections they wish to raise.
On that point, Mr. Bernheim, counsel for appellant says that there was some mix-up in the date. Is there anything in the record that could steer us to figure out whether that actually is true? And if so, whether it could have been remedied?
Yeah, but I don't know that there's anything in the record, Your Honor, that I can point to, but I will tell you the order was entered one day early. And I assure you that that is a unique circumstance here in Philadelphia for anything to occur early, but it did. And I did contact local council here, you know, said, look, if you want to file something because of that, that's fine. They could have done so. I don't believe that that would have changed the ultimate outcome. But as indicated by Mr. Heinze, they had no intention of filing anything. So to the extent that it's a procedural anomaly, I think it is a harmless error. The opportunity, there were two shots at challenging what the arbitrator did, and neither of those were selected. So what occurred is that order was then entered, and it was under, from my understanding, through the Uniform Arbitration Act, which in Pennsylvania is codified in what we refer to as the judicial code. The only place that one can go ahead and then reduce an arbitration conducted here in Pennsylvania is the county in which that arbitration was held. So consequently, while I dislike hearing the words lie or misrepresentation, whatever it is, to the court, because Minnesota Council, Ms. Moen, who is listening to this, is someone who I have garnered the utmost respect in the period of time that I've had the opportunity to work with her. I would have no doubt if she's appeared before any members of this panel, you have the same impression. Don't think that there was any misrepresentation or lies. At that point in the proceedings, what was noted is once there's a judgment entered, be it in favor of Sturzberg, the assets are here in Minnesota. And then you're going to have to come back to go ahead and liquidate the assets. That's drastically different than saying Minnesota law applies, or that the arbitration award then would have to be confirmed here in Minnesota, which is inconsistent with the Uniform Act. There's only one place. It is mandatory under the judicial code, and we've provided that citation, you know, in our brief. The argument that was raised in the court below and here was asking both courts to somewhat, respectfully, twist the language of that and state that where it indicates that the application has got to be the court in or the county in which the arbitration agreement prescribes or where the arbitration hearing was held, meaning here in Philadelphia County. The subsequent sentence reads that the arbitration hearing shall be held, or if the hearing has been held in that county in which the hearing was held is where you would file it. And that was twisted to mean the Minnesota hearing, the first case which was filed, the race to the courthouse to bring this action, which then was stayed pending the Philadelphia arbitration. The provision there is not a subject matter provision. It's a venue provision, which states which county within the state, because it has to be within the state to confirm the award. And that's what occurred. I think equally trying to challenge the Pennsylvania judgment and order on personal jurisdiction is without merit, that there was appearance here in Philadelphia and Pennsylvania. That alone would constitute a waiver of challenge of personal jurisdiction. The options when one does that is A, you challenge in the foreign jurisdiction, personal jurisdiction. B, you do nothing and wait for it to come back to the other state. But you don't have the option of appearing and in addition, filing a counterclaim, which is what was done here in Pennsylvania. And then when you lose, say, oh, by the way, you did not have personal jurisdiction over us, be it on your claim or our counterclaim. So I don't think that there's any basis upon which to legitimately challenge the Pennsylvania judgment and order, which then brings us to what the next argument is. It's vacate the arbitration award.
Before Mr. Bernheim, before you go there, can I just ask with respect to the law that applies, if the law, the challenge here is to the docketing of the foreign judgment in Minnesota, or the refusal to, you know, vacate that docketing of the judgment in Minnesota. And then one of the exception that they're arguing is, well, there is no personal jurisdiction or subject matter jurisdiction in Pennsylvania. Do we apply in Minnesota Pennsylvania's law with respect to jurisdiction then? Is that correct?
I believe so. And I also would think under the worlds of be a personal jurisdiction, if we were to then go ahead and apply the Coulter test, that even if it were raised, given the fact that the agreement says that the arbitration will be through ADR options in Philadelphia, that Mr. Wolski reached out to Mr. Sturzberg not once, but actually three times in 2005, 15, and 16 to perform business. And of the facts that were in the district court's opinion, which are not challenged in any fashion whatsoever, they are that Sturzberg and Fine was hired both as a mortgage broker and financial consultant, that they had to do major overhauls in Mr. Wolski's books and records, that there was the contractual fee of 1.5% of that, which was financed, that they did sue for a breach of contract and unjust enrichment, and that Mr. Wolski was complimentary of Mr. Sturzberg, who literally saved his park from foreclosure. And in fact, Mr. Wolski did not know why he was paid, and one step further, signed the settlement statement authorizing payment, plus issued a 1099 to Sturzberg and Fine as if they had been paid in full. And I want to keep the focus on the legal arguments here, but I think it's important when you evaluate, is there a breach of public policy, to recognize also what went on, that on the doorstep of foreclosure, Mr. Wolski had submitted a loan application, which was inaccurate. A bank rejected it. Then Mr. Heinze contacts Sturzberg and Fine, discharges them. 3 weeks later, Mr. Wolski reengages under the 2016 agreement, which is the subject here, Sturzberg and Fine, and they're capable of getting another loan with 100% of the work. This is one of the findings. 100% of the work here in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. The loan closes at 4:17 to be exact. And at 5:30 p.m., Mr. Heinze writes and says, I did some post-closing research and learned that there is no Minnesota license.
Can I ask, Mr. Bernheim, this seems to be going to the argument that it, sort of fairness argument, whether 82-85 should preclude payment here, which I guess you're wrapping into whether it's a public policy exception in order to challenge the underlying arbitration award. I'm sure it's your argument, and you, I think you started it with, if the foreign judgment is properly docketed here, we don't ever get to the validity of the arbitration.
That's correct.
Is that correct?
Yes.
I want to just turn back to that one moment in terms of docketing the foreign judgment. Mr. Heinze argues that Minnesota law 8285, by precluding anyone from bringing or maintaining an action in the courts of the state for the collection of compensation, et cetera, actually is an independent bar to the very docketing of the foreign judgment here, because it's for the purpose of collecting on that award and collecting compensation. Can you speak to that argument? What's wrong with that argument?
Well, sir, I mean, what that does, and I don't mean to be facetious, but we've just changed full faith and credit to partial faith and credit. I mean, if you have the judgment and order from one state and then you bring it to the other, you can't say, fine, we're going to give it full faith and credit, but you cannot enforce it. Those dots do not connect. And what the Minnesota statute, as I understand it, states is that what one could not do if they were not licensed was go ahead and proceed with, the enforcement, create an action or an enforcement of an action. And I went through the history of that to dovetail into the public policy argument, just as you're indicating, Judge Smith, in that what occurred here is if there had been notice to Mr. Sturzberg a week before, because he was able to get a license from the Department of Commerce within about a week or 10 days, who then wrote, we have no objection to you collecting the fee for the work that you've done, that if he knew a week before and got that license before closing, then he would have complied with the statute and the ability to go ahead and enforce, because the prohibition in the statute is that you have to have the license before the cause of action accrues. And that wouldn't accrue until closing. So the question becomes, what public policy is really being enhanced by just the timing of when one gets what it appears to be ministerial in Minnesota, with all due respect, because all Mr. Sturzberg had to do was pay a fee, and he is licensed. And I think he may have had to have a mailing address as well. But that was it, and the Department of Commerce was okay.
But let's assume for a moment that our vacated decision by the Minnesota Court of Appeals is the correct law, that Chapter 8285 actually invalidates the agreement. Let's just assume that for purposes of argument.
Mm-hmm.
Are you saying that the argument that 8285, with respect to full faith and credit, in other words, can 8285, can our decision, our earlier decision since vacated, both be right and yet full faith and credit is owed to the foreign judgment? That's my question. Or does your argument depend on our saying, you know what, we were wrong about 8285 and its application in this case?
Well, it's like maybe no to both, if I can try, because whether you apply Pennsylvania law or even Minnesota law, we provided a number of cases from other jurisdictions, the 7th, 3rd, and I think 9th, where there are very similar scenarios where you had this situation with an out-of-state mortgage broker and a similar licensing statute. And we have one here similar in Pennsylvania, and there was a Third Circuit opinion, and where the court held that the borrower, where if the only contact is in connection that the collateral's in the foreign jurisdiction, that enforcing those licensing registrations and prohibitions don't really serve an appropriate purpose, and it would be improper. Judge Johnson, where this was brought last time, was pretty astute because he didn't have a full record at that time. And he noted that, in his words, if I may, the Woskys and their attorneys willingly accepted the services contemplated by the contract and then opportunistically sought to take advantage of Sturzberg and Fine's unlicensed status to avoid paying the contractual fee. The interests of justice do not favor declaring the contract void. That's
Judge
the
Johnson
same.
Was, of course, in dissent.
That is correct. And that whole decision has been vacated by the Supreme Court, but I bring that up because it's the same rationale that those other jurisdictions that are cited in our brief also relied upon in stating that those statutes that they were reviewing didn't rise to the level of some argument that public policy should trump and therefore void a contract where somebody has received a benefit. So
if I can just ask one question about the Supreme Court opinion, and certainly the Supreme Court vacated the Court of Appeals opinion, but it does seem at the end, and I'm not the greatest interpreter of exactly what our Supreme Court is saying sometimes, but they said that the district court should be instructed to vacate the judgment and entering an order staying the underlying proceedings until arbitration is completed, suggesting that application to confirm the arbitration ought to have been made here in Minnesota.
Well, I didn't read it that way because you're then, you know, one, as I said, the Uniform Act, and Minnesota's acts is similar. You would have to, there's only one place that you could do it once you go to Pennsylvania. So once
if that's the case, and I think it may be the case, but if that's the case, then why did the Supreme Court say instead of it doesn't belong here, you would arbitrate and confirm the arbitration if at all elsewhere? Why did the Supreme Court say enter an order staying the underlying proceedings in Minnesota until arbitration is completed?
Well, my experience, Your Honor, is not just in this situation, but any other. If somebody goes to court and there's an arbitration clause, that the court will stay the matter pending the arbitration, and that arbitration decision will then direct the court what it has to do thereafter. So whether it be dismiss the case, proceed with the case, or what have you, I don't find an inconsistency there. And if you think there's difficulty understanding Minnesota Supreme Court, you should try Pennsylvania.
I was not trying to be critical.
Oh, no, I was.
Sometimes I'm not sure I follow what would happen next from its opinion.
Right. I understand. I see that my time is up, unless there are other questions.
Thank you very much, Mr. Bernheim. Mr. Heinze, you may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. I just want to touch on 82.85 again, and as it regards U.S. Supreme Court precedent, which opposing counsel didn't discuss. Again, in the Baker by Thomas case, which was from 1998, giving full faith, and as this court knows, full faith and credit to another state's judgment is not an absolute. It depends on a few factors. So in the Baker by Thomas case, as they said, the modes of executing a judgment, sovereign to the state where the foreign judgment is sought to be enforced. Every state in this nation has different rules as to how judgments may be enforced, from differing exceptions to different time requirements. And so recognizing this, the Supreme Court stated in Baker by Thomas that regarding modes of execution vis-a-vis foreign judgments, that the full faith and credit clause does not carry with it the modes of executing that judgment. So this court can honor the judgment from Pennsylvania and also recognize that 82.85, the state legislature put a complete ban on seeking collection of monies for services performed without a license.
Sorry, Mr. Heinze, I'm just looking at your brief and I just want to make sure I can go back to the case you're citing.
Yeah.
Looking in your table of authorities. What case is it? I'm not
It's the Baker, and it's in the reply brief.
Oh, in your reply brief. Okay.
Yeah, on page 18. Okay. And it's citing long-held Supreme Court precedent. I mean, the McElmoyle case, which it cites, is from 1839. So this isn't some new theory of law here. Full faith and credit. It recognizes both that it would be chaos for the country to not enforce other states' judgments, but also recognizing the sovereignty to each state, recognizing that each state gets to choose how foreign judgments may or may not be executed.
That's a little confusing to me, Mr. Heinze. Let me, hypothetically speaking, let's say there's a personal injury lawsuit in Minnesota that in compliance with, there's long arm jurisdiction. I understand your jurisdiction argument, but you have long arm jurisdiction over a non-resident. You get a judgment against the non-resident for both compensatory and punitive damages. It's reduced to judgment. It's accepted in the other state, but then the other state has a statute that says no one may collect punitive damages.
I think it would depend, Your Honor, on the specifics of what that statute says. And I know what you're getting at. And I think
that's my concern is there'd be no end to this if the state in which the foreign judgment is docketed could then apply its substantive law to decide whether we like that or it's consistent with our policy.
Well, I'll give you one that I can speak to that's not hypothetical. So in Florida, for example, judgments are good for 20 years and then that's it. They're done. If you don't execute within 20 years, you can't execute. In other states, such as ours, I believe ours is a 10-year, but it can be renewed time and time again. I don't think the Supreme Court has ruled on any finality to the end of when a judgment can be executed. The point being
I'm not sure about that. I thought there was a case called Craning from many years ago that suggested at least that in the child support arena, only one renewal was permissible, but that's going from memory of the distant past.
Fair enough, Your Honor, and I defer to your memory over mine. But the point being that there are different rules for enforcing. So if you take a foreign judgment and go to one state, you may be able to enforce it there, whereby you may not be able to enforce it in another state based upon those sorts of parameters, which is expressly what the Supreme Court was talking about in these sorts of cases, which is what 82.85 says. It doesn't say you can't. It's not a situation where the law is different, and so thereby you can't enforce the judgment. It's very specific in its punitive nature in terms of protecting Minnesota citizens. And if you are
counsel, it talks about the collection of compensation. I mean, isn't what Baker, at least what you quoted from Baker, is basically saying? I mean, when we docket a judgment here, the enforcement of the Minnesota judgment, which is docketed as a result of the foreign judgment, what's being enforced is the Minnesota judgment, and then you follow the law with respect to Minnesota enforcement of Minnesota judgments.
Right.
But it doesn't tell you not to docket a different foreign judgment here. I mean, you're talking about as if Minnesota is enforcing a Pennsylvania judgment, executing that the execution would be of the Pennsylvania judgment. Isn't the execution that will follow from the Minnesota judgment?
Yes and no, Your Honor, because the language that the legislature chose in 82.5 is that these courts will be closed to any action. And so you don't even get into the front door. And in fact, some of the case law cited in our briefing states that you don't even have standing in the state for the collection of services because of that statutory bar in 82.85. So I would submit that no, the foreign judgment doesn't even get to be docketed, that runs afoul of 82.85 in and of itself because it is a judgment for the services rendered while unlicensed, which 82.85 prohibits.
Can I ask one housekeeping matter? Do we know from the record where the Pennsylvania judgment was docketed? Was it in Pine County?
It was, Your Honor. It was docketed after we brought our motion to vacate the arbitration award.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much for your arguments this morning and for your written submissions. We will take the matter under advisement.